thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, What is America? Alan Gregg interviews Ronald Wright, who is a Canadian author of travel history and fiction. America is the world's only superpower, but how did it get there? Ronald Wright contends that right from its start as a frontier society, America has used militarism and religious extremism to expand and prosper.
America, the world's only superpower. But how did it get there? In a provocative new book, Ronald Wright contends that from its start as a frontier society, America has used militarism and religious extremism to expand and prosper. Wright is the best-selling author of A Short History of Progress. His new book is called What is America? A Short History of the New World Order. You've written another controversial book here that basically portrays America and American history in a way that Americans certainly don't see themselves, and our conventional wisdom about American history hasn't told us. Give us your basic thesis here.
The idea came to me when I was trying to answer the question, why did Tony Blair get into bed with the most extreme regime to take power in a major Western nation since 1945? And I thought it's because he doesn't, perhaps it's because, I mean, who knows, but I thought perhaps it's because he didn't know what he was dealing with. And so I began thinking really how that half of America that is has fundamentalist religious beliefs, has virtually no knowledge of the outside world, and which tends to vote hard right Republican, regardless of the facts or the record of the party in office, is out of the mainstream of Western civilization. They're not speaking the same political language that is normal in Europe, Canada, Australia, parts of Asia.
You're also making the case, I think, that you know, if you go right back to the founding of the Americas, that there's a history of imperialism, that what we're seeing in Iraq isn't just a function of a hegemonic country, the old world's only superpower having to do what it has to do for world stability or in the name of the war on terror, but this is part of a big pattern.
I make the case that the modern world we have, the industrialized, overcrowded world, really flows from the takeover of the new world that began with the old Spanish conquests of Mexico and Peru. And everything went very well for Europe, not because the New World was a wilderness, but because it was the opposite, because there were highly developed civilizations with huge piles of precious metal, and even more importantly, fantastically productive food crops, which the rest of the world appropriated, and that gave us the population boom, not only in Europe, but also in Africa, providing the labor force during this period of slavery. And both Adam Smith and Karl Marx remarked on how the gold and silver of Mexico and Peru was the startup money for the Industrial Revolution because it gravitated north. Spain spent it all on weaponry and wars, and it went into the hands of industrialists.
You write that in order to justify what the new Americans did to the Native Americans, they had to erase all evidence of civilization. Explain that.
Well, they certainly did. I mean, very few of these ancient remains are still there because most of them were deliberately pulled down, not so much purely to get rid of the evidence, but to build roads, dams, fill in hollows, that kind of thing. So there's very little of that ancient architecture left now. But deep down, the American, the white American idea of their country is based on the idea of a wilderness, an empty land, with just a few, quote, savages. And the Europeans come, bring civilization, and build an ideal society. The truth of the matter is that the country was built on the slaughter of one race and the enslavement of another, and that the so-called pioneers, that most of their progress across the continent, and remember, it took 300 years to get from one side to the other, that was an essentially parasitic process of taking over a going concern, an existing agricultural system. And it nowhere is that clearer than with the Pilgrim Fathers.
And you see this as a relatively uninterrupted arc from the expansion of the frontier right to Iraq.
It has always been an empire. Of course, at first, it was a British empire. It was part of the British Empire. And then when the American settlers took it over under local management, it was still an empire. George Washington called the United States a rising empire. And at that time, he was referring specifically to the conquest of the North American continent.
And they were all fixated with the expansion west.
Yes,
Washington
absolutely.
Was one of the biggest landowners in America.
In fact, one of the reasons for the revolution was that the British had tried to draw a line between Native America and British America and the settlers. Washington already had got land on the wrong side of the line and he wanted to sell.
Thank you.
notion that America has always had expansionary aspirations, I mean, runs very contrary to a lot of the major mythologies. I mean, we think of George Washington's farewell letter, basically saying, you know, do not get embroiled in the British-French war. The Monroe Doctrine, you know, do not get involved in anything. Don't have any allegiances. George Bush, when he comes, he says, I have no interest in nation building. Are these just kind of isolated contradictions to what this larger pattern that you see?
No, I think the larger pattern is absolutely clear. I mean, even the Monroe Doctrine is an imperial doctrine, because the Monroe Doctrine isn't saying we don't want to get involved in foreign wars. It's saying to foreign powers, don't get involved in our hemisphere. And our hemisphere isn't just what is now the United States. It's all of Latin America and Canada, which, of course, the United States was still hoping to include in its empire at that point. So the Monroe Doctrine is explicitly imperial, and then even more so is the Manifest Destiny, which mixes the idea of expansion, the sort of political and economic idea of expansion, is mixed with the sort of religious fervor, which began with the Puritans.
I want to get into the religious fervor, because I think that is very, very interesting. But first you say, and you write, that the American empire hasn't done things that are worse than any other empires have done over the course of history. They just forget the bad things quicker and see them as aberrations rather than a pattern. Explain that to me and why that is.
That is the problem. There is this core belief in the nation as the world's best hope, as the most advanced and most perfect system. And therefore, its imperfections and its dishonorable origins and actions in the past have to be disowned and suppressed and forgotten. The origin of that idea has there are two different origins. One is the religious origin with the Puritans, who believe that they were migrating. They saw their history through the lens of the Old Testament and believed that they were migrating to a promised land given them by God, and that there they would build a heaven on earth, a theocracy. In fact, the Puritan project was not very different from, say, the Taliban project, trying to build a nation state that was in accordance with the rules of God as they thought they understood them. And then there was the secular vision of the Founding Fathers, which came out of the 18th century Enlightenment. People like Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, architects of both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And their idea was to build a perfect society, but it was a secular one. It was to be an ideal political arrangement, a model democracy in which yeoman farmers and individuals, free individuals, would govern themselves through the exercise of reason in their own enlightened best interests.
Exactly.
And those two things have always been at loggerheads. You know, on the one hand, you've got people who think God is talking to them and telling them what to do, and whose sense of history is completely mythological. It's not based in reality at all and not based on reason at all. And on the other hand, you have this naive belief in the perfectibility of man through the exercise of his intelligence.
And both of these are seen as perfect systems, though.
They're both seen as perfect systems. Neither of them is, of course, and they are at loggerheads and always have been. You know, we forget that the pilgrims only survived because they happened to show up at a time when the population of a native town called Patuxet had died of smallpox, leaving their houses, all the winter corn put up, and fields prepared for the spring. The pilgrims actually moved into the Indians' houses, ate their winter corn, then planted their fields in the spring. And then, this is the key part, instead of acknowledging that fact, then wrote a history within 10 years of this, when it all must have been fresh in their minds, wrote a history claiming that there was nothing there but a wilderness, nothing there but savages who were trying to fill their sides full of arrows, and that the only thing that saved them was the grace of God. Where in actual fact, the survivors from that smallpox plague had tried to make an alliance with these pilgrims and had shown them how to grow corn, how to operate the American farming system.
The other interesting thing is that whenever America has kind of explored outside of its borders, it has always done so with the justification of high moral purpose. Mm-hmm. We're liberating, we're keeping free. This is part of the founding mythology?
Yes, indeed. I mean, in order to to paper over the unsavory fact of imperial conquest, ethnic cleansing, because there was a deliberate program, of course, of removing the Eastern Indians carried out by President Jackson, probably the worst ethnic cleansing ever carried out by a democracy. 100,000 people or more rounded up, put in internment camps, shipped across the Mississippi, and many of them dying in the process. Again, it was a parasitic thing. These particular native tribes had modernized in the early 19th century way and were living according to, they had their own constitutions. The more prosperous people lived in brick houses. They had commercial farms and roads, wagons, schools, the whole thing, even a bilingual newspaper in the case of the Cherokees. And they had done all that on the promise that if they did that, the white Americans would let them keep their sovereignty. As small independent nations in North America. That's what Thomas Jefferson had promised them. And the Supreme Court upheld that, and yet Jackson said, we've got to get rid of these Indians. And of course, because they had succeeded, they had actually been the true pioneers. They had built a ready-made estate for the whites to take over. And then, of course, after that, then America begins to move against having dispossessed most of the native people in the farming zone, then begins to move against other countries.
Mexico,
yes.
And again,
as you point out, with the idea that trying to cloak this conquest of Mexico, which was started on false pretenses by the Americans, as a sort of a liberating thing, something that would civilize the Mexicans and improve them.
You quote a historian at the time, writing about the invasion of the Philippines by America,
yeah.
and noting that it could have been written in 2008 about the invasion of Iraq.
Yes, Tyler Dennett, writing in 1922, which was only 20 years after the Philippines War, a terrible war. It's been called by a Filipino historian America's first Vietnam, and there were unspeakable atrocities there. Whole villages and towns massacred, and waterboarding and things like that. And Tyler Dennett, writing 20 years after that, said that the war was entered into in complete ignorance of the facts of the situation and in the mistaken assumption that conquest by the American people would be received as a superlative blessing.
With flowers and laurels.
Exactly.
Yet for all of this, and you make a powerful case because you can point to the examples of Hawaii, of Vietnam, of a country that is, you know, constantly kind of extending its reach into the world. Until very recently, America was much admired as this beacon of a perfect society. How do you explain that contradiction?
The early imperial phase did come to an end in the 1930s. And at that time, the Americans pulled out of the Philippines, which was their only really big overseas possession in the sense of a formal empire, that they saw as the European empires found out that, you know, a territorial empire where you formally acquire territory and then responsible for schooling, health, roads, all of those things, can be very expensive. Under FDR and during the Great Depression, the Philippines were given back their independence, except for a few parts kept as naval bases. And then, of course, under FDR with the New Deal, you had a very different policy. You also had some redress for the wrongs to some of the Native Americans. And in the Second World War, America really did emerge as the world's best hope. And let's not forget that after the First World War, too, it was the United States, Woodrow Wilson, who created the League of Nations, which didn't really succeed that well, and which he was never able to get the United States Congress to ratify the treaty.
Well, in fact, you see Woodrow Wilson and FDR as kind of outliers, that they are aberrants in terms of the patterns of American ambition.
Well, they certainly realized, I think, that the age of imperial aggression had come to an end with the First World War. And it took the Europeans sort of had to learn that lesson twice. And towards the end of the Second World War, just before FDR died, yes, he convened this conference to construct a fairer world order that would be based on reducing the gap between rich and poor, creating the United Nations to arbitrate international disputes, managing the banking and financial systems so that on Keynesian lines, so that, you know, governments would tax in the good times and therefore have reserves to spend in the downside of the business cycle. All of those, America really did learn the lessons of the first half of the 20th century and helped the Europeans to take those lessons on board. The sad part is that since then, since say 1950, America has forgotten those lessons and returned to an archaic worldview. And this began during the Cold War with the reaction that sort of rabid anti-communism that came out, and then was cemented during the Reagan and Thatcher era with the with Reaganomics, with the idea that we don't have to manage the capitalist economy. We just let it rip and everything will be fine. Everyone will get rich.
You've touched on a number of times that a lot of the imperial initiatives that America has undertaken have their root in a fundamentalist religious philosophy. In fact, you go as far as to say is that, you know, the United States is the most religious country in the Western Hemisphere. Well, how did that come
about?
It's
not just I who say that. I mean, many Americans say that. And without question about, you know, opinion polls have shown that roughly half the population of the United States believes in the creation story, the biblical creation story. It believes that it's literally true. So roughly half the population are fundamentalist Christians. The rest of Christendom gave up fighting Darwin a century ago. And this is one example of what I call the archaism in backwoods America. And by backwoods America, I mean that culture founded by the Puritans, which ramified on the frontier and spread across the continent in isolation, really, from the eastern seaboard and from the rest of European civilization. So the process recognized by the American historian Frederick Jackson Turner as long ago as 1893.
Mm-hmm. The old frontier thesis.
The frontier thesis, and I think he's essentially right, that the what makes America different from the rest of the Western world and makes that hinterland culture out of the mainstream of the West was that experience of the frontier. It was a place in which a new culture came into being, a culture that was very much cut off from its European roots, which absorbed quite a lot of indigenous elements, particularly the farming system. Also, though, less happily, because there was a 300-year war zone against the original Americans, mm-hmm. It became a very militarized culture, as well as an extremely fundamentalist religious culture with a belief that it was good fighting evil. The Puritans and the settlers were the forces of good fighting the Indians, who were the armies of Satan. And that pattern, of course, has continued long after the Indians were confined to reservations. Pretty soon the communist menace emerges as the forces of evil.
Well, in fact, you find the parallel founding myths of America manifest today, in what you've called kind of backwoods America and enlightened America. Others mm-hmm. have called red and blue states. We're talking about basically the same things?
More or less the same thing, although we have to, I mean, that's an oversimplification. Obviously, these two cultural traditions interpenetrate, mm-hmm. and they are very much tied in with education level, social class, and so forth. But there is a geographical component, because that hinterland culture still predominates in the hinterland and is less strong in the cities and the seaboards.
You also make the point, however, that, you know, while this outlook is very indigenous and has grown up in America because of the unique set of circumstances that are at work in America, that America has also exported its way mm-hmm. to the rest of the world. Expand on that.
Well, the extraordinary success. I mean, the United States is really the only country which simultaneously had the experience of conquering this vast land full of resources at the same time as the Industrial Revolution was bearing fruit. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the history of America, the first 200 years, say between 1600 and 1800, the white Americans have only moved a couple of hundred miles
right.
into North America. That's really the only territory they control. And if they kept going at that speed, they'd only be at the Mississippi today. But suddenly along comes the steamboat, and then the railway, and the machine gun, and the repeating rifle, and ultimately barbed wire, this humble invention of barbed wire. And the expansion becomes, it accelerates drastically. So there's this sense of triumphalism, of imperial conquest linked to technological invention.
Right.
And that really gives us the modern industrial age. Of course, other countries were industrializing. Britain was industrializing a little ahead of the Americans at first, but was very soon overtaken by the Americans.
The But you write also about what you see as the fallacy between the link of technological sophistication and moral sophistication.
Oh, yes. I mean, that 19th century idea that technical progress brings moral progress, that was all went up in smoke in the trenches of the First World War.
But there still is this kind of sense, is that, you know, if you are, as the United States is, you know, the leading technological industrial country in the world, that you must have some kind of moral foundation.
Well, certainly that's, you know, they just as the British had, they had that sense that they were in tune with the universe, that and assumed that all of their good fortune was their own doing, when in fact, of course, it was the appropriation of thousands of years of civilization that had already existed in the Americas, the appropriation of this vast tract of land with all its resources, and the acceleration of industrial progress, which had not been started by the Americans, but which they were very good at adopting and putting into effect. But that technological, not only is there not necessarily a moral progress that goes with it, but there isn't necessarily a cultural modernity that goes with it, because that backwoods or culture, or that blue red states that we've been talking about, are deeply archaic. It's a worldview locked in the 17th century in the religious wars between the Roundheads and the Cavaliers. It's still there. The project of letting God run the world and knowing what he wants and carrying it out for him.
The very fact that Barack Obama was able to rise up from where he was and capture America's imagination, does that suggest that this backwoods America that you're talking about, this archaic view of the world, is starting to crumble in the United States, that they in fact are flexible and open enough to change?
Well, the country obviously is a tremendously complex and vibrant country. What's happened is, I mean, we've seen power sort of change hands in the 20th century. In the first half of the 20th century, it was mainly in the hands of democratic administrations, mm-hmm. who were very much internationalist in outlook and were progressive and really did build that good reputation that America, that good name that America had after the Second World War. And then since then, we've seen a predominance of Republican administrations who have squandered that legacy. The extraordinary thing, I mean, is how close it is and how little the facts matter. I think in most other democracies, if a record like that of the Bush Republicans would have been enough to put them down in the teens, not just a few percentage points. Because most people are not voting on the basis of the facts, that most of those people who were voting Republican were voting on the basis of what they perceived to be shared religious beliefs and shared values, and with complete disregard for the actual facts of the policies of the Bush regime and even what it has done to their own lives. The irony, really, and the success of the Republican Party in the late 20th century was that they managed to, the people who had the most in America and who were tied into what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex and who made absolute fortunes, managed to persuade many of the people who have very little in America that they share the same interests by pushing that button of religious fundamentalism and family values.
Now, this is a pretty rough analysis of American history, tough analysis of American history and American intentions. We share a continent. We share, you know, a lot of that history together. We share a lot of those sensibilities and tastes. I mean, how much of this could apply to Canada?
I think Canada sits pretty well in the middle between a modern European nation and the United States. And parts of our country, of course, do have high levels of religious fundamentalism and fairly right-wing political views. But in general, I think Canada still is part of the mainstream of the West, of the modern Western civilization, whereas about half the United States is not. And I think one reason I wrote What is America is that I think outsiders, we need to know that when backwards America comes to power, as it did under Ronald Reagan and as it did most disastrously under George W. Bush, we need to realize that we're not dealing with people who speak modern internationalist diplomatic language. We're dealing with people who who pull out of international treaties to deal with environmental problems, who pull out of international human rights treaties, who pull out of an attempt to build of the International Criminal Court to bring war criminals and other people like that to justice, who in effect have trashed the international order that Americans helped to build earlier in the 20th century under Woodrow Wilson and FDR. And I think when those sorts of, when that an administration of that sort takes power And I don't think that George W. Bush will be the last of those, necessarily. The rest of the Western world has to sort of step back and not be dragooned to war on the basis of extremely flimsy evidence.
For the time being, we have a financial meltdown that has pretty much put major question marks to this notion that progress is normal, is disgraced market freehand Milton Friedman kind of theories. And we have President Barack Obama. I mean, is backwards America firmly in the closet now for the foreseeable future?
Well, I would say I don't think we should be complacent about that. I think look what happened to Jimmy Carter, for example. The right-wing reactionary forces in America will do all they can to bring President Obama down and to frustrate his programs and to return to the sorts of policies that were practiced under the Bush regime. At the same time, America probably is ready for the sort of transformation that took place under Franklin Roosevelt with the New Deal. There are some interesting parallels. The financial system has discredited itself by reckless greed and exuberance. It's amazing to me that anyone is surprised by what's happened, because when all the regulations were taken off, it was just a matter of time. How long would it take? So there's that. The wars, again, those America recognizes, I think, that those wars are unwinnable, and that therefore the only way is to seek compromise, to seek international agreements and structures. Also, we have to, America is beggaring, like other empires in the past, America is beggaring itself to maintain its military predominance. The economy is smaller than that of the European Union, and yet the military spending is greater than at least the top 20 other countries in the world put together. That's unsustainable.
Ronald Wright, I want to thank you very much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
That's all, folks.